You are listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. Thank you for downloading and subscribing. Coming to you virtually live from high atop the historic Raleigh building in beautiful downtown Raleigh. The NCF&B takes the listener behind the scenes to tell the stories of the people that contribute to the creation of the food and beverage community of North Carolina. And now, the misfits in the dish pit, the faces of the front. They are Max Trujillo and Matthew Weiss.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. I am your co-host, Max Trujillo.
And I am your co-host, Matthew Weiss. And I just want to say, cheese! Finally, the day has arrived. I have been talking to Max for this low 4 years,
yeah,
saying we need a cheese episode. We have to talk about cheese. We both love cheese. And I went to everybody in the Triangle local area and said, hey, who should we talk to about cheese? Who should we get? And pretty much everybody, our buddy Blake Gottlieb, the good folks out at, you know, Ben Barker and his son out at Pizzeria Mercato, they're like, well, we personally, we love Boxcar. So we tracked them down. And they are here today, the great brother and sister team of Boxcar Handmade Cheese. We have Austin and Samantha Genke. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you so much for having us.
You know, Matt, it's the early bird that may get the worm, but the second mouse gets the cheese.
Ooh, is that new or is that like an actual thing? I've never heard that before.
Yeah, have you guys ever heard that before?
No, not new one for me.
So. Are you familiar with what the most religious cheese is?
Oh, what is it?
It's Swiss, because it's holy.
Those will That's fall it. Under the dad jokes category.
I'm done. Well, welcome you to it. We appreciate it. Let's frame it out a little bit right now. Matt and I already have full bellies of cheese because you were gracious enough to. I mean, when I say hand us a little bit, you didn't hand us a little bit. You gave us like the portfolio of cheese that Boxcar is producing at this moment. And I'll get into that in a quick moment as to how we got it and where we got it. But we have this amazing array of cheese here in the kitchen studios right now. And luckily for us, we had a little bit of time right before. So we just dipped in.
Not a shred of that will be wasted.
The saltines we bought?
They were not. Saltines.
So good. So we had to throw those away and then get some Ritz crackers to help out, be our vessel for this cheese. But oh my gosh, like I am so satisfied right now. And there's still so much cheese. We're going to be eating a lot of cheese this next week.
The families will be happy. So you're out there in Cedar Grove next to our buddies who we collaborated with on a Botanist and Barrel wine with Defy Wine. I imagine your buddies with them as well. You let's get into your story. You started this in 2009 with the farm, and then a couple of years, I think 2015, with the creamery. So, Samantha, you were making cheese to begin with. Austin, I believe you were a chef somewhere up north, and then you guys said, let's partner up. So take it from there.
Exactly.
Yeah, we grew up together. We're really weirdly close. And so it was hard the time that we were, you know, living in different places in the country. So the plan was, okay, how do we make it so we could get back together and live in the same place and work on the same projects again? Because we, growing up, we worked in a lot of the same restaurants and we really missed that. So Austin and his wife moved here in 2009. They found a cute little farm in Cedar Grove. And we tried doing a bunch of different things, farming, vegetables,
food truck, catering.
Yeah. And then I think Austin finally was like, this is crazy. We need to write a business plan and have some sort of brick and mortar something. And so we thought we would, I made cheese during the day as my day job, but we were thinking, you know, maybe we would do a restaurant since that was within him and I were doing as our night jobs for forever. And so I think Austin wrote a business plan for that, but then he kind of was like, well, what if I write one for a cheese place? I was like, all right, if you can get a loan, write one for a cheese place. And so I think he wrote both business plans at the same time, and we ended up getting a good amount of funding for the cheese thing, not all of it, but a good amount of it to go forward with it. And we decided to stop doing all the other stuff. Like, we still worked our night jobs and did it. I think, yeah, just our night jobs. But the farming, the catering, we really kind of pared down on that. And then we started making cheese here.
Yeah.
And what was the thought initially? Because you had sort of an idea. It wasn't just like, oh, let's make cheese, because you know, cheese gets so complicated and segmented that you have to have even like more specific ideas. So how did you kind of round out your portfolio and decide which cheese you would make?
I think we knew we had to be different, obviously, one, locally, but also two, throughout the country. And then I think it was also just working in restaurants, kind of knowing how we wanted the cheese to present, flavor profiles, our roots, and just kind of our philosophy with food, just, you know, very simple, which came down to like Italian style cooking. And we knew that that would be a big part of what we wanted to put into the cheese. Also with, you know, developing our own local spin on things. And of course, all the Italian wonderful cheeses and recipes Samantha has developed too. So
yeah, I think we felt like when we looked at the market, there was a lot of French cheese represented. We're our family's Italian American, but we're Italian, and we worked in a lot of high end Italian restaurants. So a lot of the food that we knew and were comfortable with were along those lines. And we're like, there's not really. There was one woman making Ribollas, but just on such a small scale. I think in the Midwest somewhere.
Yeah, it's very hard to get. Very expensive.
Yeah, and then the Italian Ribollas were very much, you know, overripe by the time you got them, often raw milk, but soft cheeses. So by the time they were legal to be shipped to the U.S., they were very ripe. And I think distribution has improved somewhat. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll see more Ribollas here and there, but often they're quite ripe when you do get your hands on them, and they're quite expensive. And so we really wanted to fill that void in the cheese market. And then I have a lot of experience making soft cheeses more in a French style or an American style, but it was easy to kind of transfer that over to like what we wanted to do with Italian cheeses. And we make mostly soft ripened cheeses. We're working on some harder ones that age out. We have some semi-soft cheeses, but mainly it's that just the cheese I've been making for many years at other places, you know, that kind of soft cheese, that sort of recipe, but then adapted to, you know, an Italian style with Italian cultures and different flavor profile. But yeah.
Yeah, that's, I was going to ask. So where had you been making cheese prior to you deciding that you were going to make cheese professionally on your own?
I worked at Chapel Hill Creamery for a really long time, maybe like 9 years. And then I worked at Goat Lady for quite a while, just two seasons in the cheese room, but also outside. And when I first moved here, I moved here for an internship at Goat Lady Dairy doing the animals outside. And then I caught that I need to have a bunch of goat bug. And so I moved here, got a bunch of goats, rented little farmettes, cheese and kitchen, and sold it to the waitresses I worked with for like a drink after work or whatever. So I did that for many years while still like my 9 to 5 or 7 to 3 was making cheese somewhere else, and then would wait the tables at night.
Making cheese during the day.
It was crazy.
Waitressing at night.
Yeah.
And somehow raising goats at the same time.
Yeah. It was stupid.
And driving from Goat Lady Dairy in Climax, North Carolina to Durham at Piedmont when it first opened.
Yeah.
And then back at night afterwards. So, yes.
It was an hour drive.
And so to kind of go back a little bit, there was a lot of buildup to the creamery. Like, Samantha is a professional cheesemaker. And when we did come out here, it was a dream of ours to be able to do something. And it was always kind of one of those things. And to be able to, like, obviously partner with your sister is amazing. And to use her talents.
Not for everybody, but
yeah.
For us it works.
Yeah. Well, you get through the first couple of years, and then it could be an amazing
day. Yeah, I wouldn't do the first year again.
No, never. No. But
yeah, we were thinking like either a restaurant or... When we started this, I was like, okay, we're not going to raise our own animals because I had way too many goats, because I've been trying to make cheese on the side with all these goats that I can't really afford to feed, which is why I have to bartend or wait tables. And
yeah,
you know, like it was like, oh, well, maybe we'll just like farm and sell milk. Well, you don't make money doing that. And then we tried to get rid of the goats, thinking like, well, we'll buy milk, see if we can make cheese that we can sell, hopefully maybe win an award. And then that way, at that point, if we become well known and people want this product, then we could go back and reinvest in this crazy herd that's just losing money and whatever. So, but when I did go to sell the goats, it was really hard because I had had them from when I was 21 until, what was that? Like I was 31. Yeah. I had them for like 10 years. And so I was picking and choosing who I wanted to sell and, you know, so that we could focus on doing this. But I mean, we had to otherwise, because this was like, you know, 100 hours a week worth of work. It wasn't going to make sense for us to try and do both at the same time, but
very much so.
Yeah.
You had to Sophie's choice your kids. That's what they call little goats, kids.
But then I still had to rent little farmette, you know, houses because I had like 12 or 13 I couldn't get rid of. And so they
which most of them she still has to this day.
I still have just but at come my on. House.
There was probably like one of those goats that where you're like, oh, I can't wait to get rid of you.
Yeah.
You pain in the ass.
Oh, yeah.
But, but that's one that lives, that's one that lives the longest and is still there. So.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Nobody else would take them.
No one else wanted. I felt bad selling her. Yeah. But I think we, so at this point that's now, great. We're back to Austin and his wife built a herd from totally different goats. My goats are like grandmothers now. They're old. And they got some beautiful goats from a herd up in Vermont, and they've built their herd the last three, four years. Yeah, because you have to build it up for a couple years before you actually start milking. But him and his wife, Danny, have been building that for quite a few years, and we've been milking. We built a milking parlor last year.
Last year, we finished it last year. So we milked 2 months last year, and this is our first full year milking all of our own goat herd.
So you have we've 90 goats now and planning on keeping and growing that herd. Is that right?
Yeah, we're milking about 56 next year, about 70. And then we want to get to around 100, 150 and kind of long-term cap it at 150 for sure. But I don't know if I've mentioned that to everybody, but I think 150 is kind of what
150 goats. Do you have to name them all?
They are all named, yes.
Yeah.
And I bet our kids actually probably tell you the names of them all.
Who's who?
So, And some of them have three names. So
that's the crazy thing about the whole cheese making process is it's like, oh, it doesn't it sound romantic to like make cheese and do all that? Meanwhile, like there is a huge part of the job that is just raising these goats. And then you obviously you make cow's milk and goat's milk, but you don't raise cows. Primarily, that's the one you did take a stance on that one. You're like, no, we're just going to buy the cow's milk, which I can understand.
No one wants
that's a whole other thing
At this farm.
Yeah, at this very moment.
But it took us a while, but we found a really awesome younger farmer that we really jive with, like personally and politically. And, you know, like he's cool and he's really far away. He's in Charlotte.
Yeah.
So Austin does drive to pick up his milk. His milk's beautiful. He milks Jerseys. His wife is a cow scientist.
Yeah, and she works up the street at one of the dairy research things that's funded by state.
Super pro and great. And so it took us a while to find like one farm of cow's milk that worked for us. But his
and they're
milk
all Jerseys.
Really,
he's been raising them for a really long time. Yeah. Since he was like 6 years old, he's been showing these Jersey cows. And so it's really, we've been using prior to this two or three different farms. Great quality milk, but still just a lot of fluctuation, inconsistencies, which, you know, just for a business, you do need to have somewhat consistency in a product that is so inconsistent seasonally anyways. So, you know.
Yeah. So it feels really good just to be milking our own animals and having one farm that we source the cow's milk from.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. I do want to know a little bit about Austin, your backstory. I saw on your LinkedIn profile that you had worked for...
I guess I did.
It did say that back in your history that you worked for the Batali and Bastianich Hospitality Group at the MGM Casino in Las Vegas, which that sounds very fancy. Obviously, Batali and Bastianich are best known for like Italy and Pizzeria Mozza in Los Angeles, where I've frequented a few times, some of the best pizza you can find on the West Coast at all. obviously that had had you in the kitchens cooking, learning from some of the more prolific, fantastic, well-known chefs. How does that play into this whole role? Like, speak to us a little bit about your culinary history.
Definitely. So I was working two jobs actually out there. One was at the MGM Grand, and then the other one was at the Venetian, which was for Mario Batali and Joe Bastianich, which was a great experience. And so, of course, that's really where I got to understand the simplicity of food and how ingredients became a huge part in it. And, of course, cheese plates. That's really where I like saw all these square cheeses, these raviolas, where I was like, okay, like, we definitely, this is something different. So I thought that was really exciting. But I mean, it allowed us to a point to where we knew that we wanted to move to North Carolina and to start farming and doing something completely different as well. So,
and that I'm sorry, I have to run. I'm sorry. His story is interesting. He definitely worked too many hours and super hard, and everyone he worked with loved him. I'll add
Samantha,
that. But
can I ask you two more questions before you have to run? Because I know you have to go do something with the rennet, which I want. That's one of the questions.
I
want you
to explain rennet to the bag rennet of milk. Yeah.
Explain that, and then I think this question
like
is directly
a time sensitive thing.
Okay, so maybe answer this if you can. Taleggio. Is there going to be a Taleggio style cheese coming, or is there?
We do. We make a Lissom, which is a beer. We add beer to the milk when we add the culture. It's a modified Taleggio recipe. All of our recipes are really modified from like the original. So the curd, we're a little bit tougher on the curd, it's a little bit stronger in structure than a Taleggio.
Yeah, because Taleggio is like semi-soft to sometimes almost runny.
Yeah. We're like on the semi-soft side, like the last point you could call it that. And the Lissom is probably my favorite cheese that we make.
Yeah,
it's also washed in beer. It's funky, but the texture is just so awesome. It's somewhere between like a not real cheese, like a cheese product, you know, and a Taleggio. It's just like that kind of weird texture right in between that I love, and it's pretty addicting. Yeah. But yeah, that's our Taleggio, ode to Taleggio. We also make a cheese that is similar to that called Campo. We smoke it. It does not have the beer, but the consistency is the same and the funkiness is the same. It's a little bit firmer version of that Lissom.
And I can tell you why we designed it that way versus the other Taleggio going more tacky and sticky and funky.
I think people like it on the mild side.
I'm tasting it right now. Well, I definitely see the relationship. Yeah, that makes sense to Taleggio.
So you're going to do what with the rennet? I know none of these words. I don't know what any of this means. So I know you got to go do it. So just tell us real quick.
I got to go do it, but I'll give you a really quick. You have a vat of milk. It's really sweet. The pH is really high. You have to add culture so that your cheese starts to acidify. Once it gets to a certain point, which the cheesemaker decides, you add rennet, which makes it coagulate, like look like Jell-O. And then it sets for a certain amount of time. Each recipe is different, and the cheesemaker kind of decides when to cut it. But the longer it sits in that set time, the firmer the curd is. So you cut it when you want it, just depending on the cheese that you're making. You stir it, stir some of the whey out, wait for more acid to develop, and then you scoop it. So I'm going to go add the rennet part right now. So it doesn't get too acidic.
Yeah, we don't want people to be like, man, their cheeses were great until that NCFB podcast. Cheese,
yeah.
That one day.
They're going to start looking at the law numbers where they can track it back to this day.
Yeah.
They added that damn rennet.
Well,
I can taste
so
it.
Thank you so much. Y'all have a good day.
You too. Thanks, Samantha.
Go cut the cheese.
Another dad joke.
Okay. I'm good with the dad jokes. But you did mention the beer wash, and that was, I said to Matt, I was really curious as to what that is, why that is, how that is. And he's like, well, it's a good thing we're going to talk to somebody that knows what that means. But what does that mean? If you're washing in beer, why beer? What does the beer do? Does it flavor it? And what kind of beer? Let's learn about that. I'm curious.
Of course. So basically, beer in general, one, it's a, for my, like, just right off the bat, it's a marketing thing. It's getting us to talk about it. So I think that's always one good thing. Right. And then two, like, it's a washed rind cheese. You have to wash it with some type of liquid. When you hear washed rind cheese, notoriously, they're going to be a little bit more pungent, a little bit more funky, but you're also adding a culture, which is called Breve Bacterium Linens, or B linens for short, into your liquid with salt. And of course, we want to use beer instead of just water to add a little bit more flavor. So that's really what it is. It's a washed rind cheese. Most people would actually end up using water. So instead, we decide to use beer on that cheese. We also add beer to the recipe, which adds a little more uniqueness to the cheese. It's a live culture beer, so we add it when we add the culture, so there's no cooking out the culture in it. It's an Italian blonde ale that we get from a friend's the kids, actually, long story short, Jay at Piedmont Wine imports a wine from the family whose kids brew this beer. So we know them very well. My sisters visited them along with Danny. So that's why we chose to use a blonde ale from Italy on this cheese in particular.
So the technique is Italian by trade. Is that fair to say?
It's not. It's a way of preserving the rind. French, Italian, let's say more European in general. You know, I think it's a way of basically inoculating it with a good mold so the bad molds, the black molds and the blue molds don't grow on it.
What say you about eating the rind? I'm of the opinion that you always eat the rind. And people look at me and like, ah.
To each their own. I always say you should try the rind. Whether you like it or not, that's up to you. Most rinds, unless it's a waxed rind, obviously like a sure. Manchego, like some of our Winsomes and stuff, they might not pass through you as well. But, I feel like it's really, if you like the rind, I think in our cheese, I don't want to say snobby age where we have so much cheese, we go right to the center. But also there's some rinds I do like, you know, I do like the Bloomy rinds. I like the Riviola rinds. The washed rinds are, you know, a little bit more pungent, a little more aromatic. The texture is a little more chalky in a way because it is mold that's growing and dying and kind of reconstituting. I mean, I've had so many people turn their nose up at me because I cut off the rind. I always try and leave that to the customer. If I'm doing a sampling, I'll cut a little piece of the rind and the cheese and let them grab it by it and spit it out if they would like. So, yeah, it's up to you.
Okay, to each his own. One quick anecdote away from cheese. Mm-hmm. Your wife, Danny, her name is, who helped set up this interview. Thank you. Are you perchance a Game of Thrones fans?
We do, but that is not, I don't think that ties into much of our day to day.
Yeah, she's not like 8 years old, Matt.
Game
of Thrones just came
out. My follow-up question to that was, did she feel validated in her name? I mean, when that series came out, and did she make you call her Khaleesi?
Oh, no.
Oh, my.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, see, we love our Game of Thrones, but yeah, I wouldn't have ever put it together. But yeah.
No one else would have either, so that's totally fine.
Awesome. Now, you're not the only one that can make bad dad jokes, okay?
Yeah. So, but getting back to the beer, one more last thing, because it's like this great marketing tool, it begs the question, why wouldn't you use a North Carolina local brewery, because there's so many great breweries out here.
You thought we were just throwing softball questions out.
Yeah, what's up?
Well,
we're not good enough for your cheese? Is that what you're trying to tell us?
So we're actually in a great transition period. One, I'll talk about that in a second. But so what happened was the Lissom came about at a time where a lot of our friends' breweries, you know, Mystery Brewing at that time and some other ones were doing a lot of seasonal beers. We knew we needed something consistent because it was a cheese when we were starting out. We wanted to market it. Jay at Piedmont Wine Imports, a good friend of ours and the business, and of course my sister and Danny going out there to Italy and stuff and knowing this family and this connection. That's why we really chose to use that beer. But we do have the nimble where we always use a local beer. So that's kind of our nimble is our mixed milk cheese. It's the cow and goat. It's our aged cheese. Actually, for the last couple of years, we've been using Steel Strings, just a variety of their beers. But with the Lissom, we're actually not going to be able to get this beer for a couple of years. So we are in the hunt for a nice blonde ale, something live. So we're throwing it out there. Local North Carolina that we can use that's consistent, that people have all year round. That we can buy the smaller, kegs of. I think this is a great time to kind of toss that out there. And you guys know beer probably a lot better than me. Also, honestly, I'm not the biggest, I should know more about beer. I like drinking it, but, you know, at the same time.
Well, your brain is reserved for cheese, and I'm sure there's so much information about cheese in there. You don't need to know about the beer. Well, that's a great thing. Let's put that out there. So for those of you beer makers out there, breweries, submit to Boxcar and get your beer on a cheese rind.
And if you give your beer to Boxcar, then you'll also give us a free keg of beer, too, because we mentioned it here on the podcast.
That's correct.
We're always looking out for us first.
Exactly.
So, okay, but you're washing it here. By the way, this is a little off subject, but I do like to give love to the local businesses, especially those that are doing things that they're doing right now. And it reminded me. Matt and I, we had a few cocktails and some burritos at a local
socially
place.
Socially distant, of course.
Socially distant and outdoors. But we went to Gallo Pelon last weekend on Friday night. They just opened the Garden of Maya Juel, which is their patio on the second floor just above Centro in downtown Raleigh. And they did these great socially distant. I mean, they built it. I believe John Cooper is a local GC in the area. He built it all, put it together. But it's almost like reminiscent of a traditional Japanese sushi dining room, where everyone's in their own little compartments in a way, and separated with paper and all. So we ended up going out there. We had a really good time. I brought that up because not only were we having a good time, but as the cocktails were flowing, Matt told me, "Do you know why people like red blends so much?" Talking about wine. And I'm like, "I don't know." And he was about to tell me the answer, but instead he goes, "Put it in the calendar and save it for the podcast." So, Matt, I'm asking you right now, why do you think people like red blends so much?
Well, this has absolutely nothing to do with cheese, so I think we'll have to cut this from this episode. But I'll tell you.
I love hearing it.
Well, I just had this epiphany as I was drinking a red blend. It was this new wine from Broadbent Selections. It's called their Douro Red, and it's almost why we love to shop at places like Target or Costco, right? It just has everything, and it might not be the best or the most crafted, but it's just easy to think about. And in a red blend, I also think that people are intimidated by I need to be drinking Pinot Noir, or I need to like Cabernet Sauvignon, but maybe you don't, and maybe you don't want to think about it. So it's the very simple little kind of best of everything, and it just all comes together, and it's
a crowd pleaser.
It's a crowd pleaser, and it's comforting in its non-descriptiveness.
Yeah, I don't think that it's totally odd to talk about wine when we're talking about cheese.
Well, okay,
remember there's the old proverb that you buy on bread and sell on cheese. You ever heard that old term?
Yeah,
meaning that. If you're buying wine, you should just eat bread with your wine, because the bread will help expose the imperfections in the wine. And so if it doesn't taste bad with bread, then you know it's a pretty good wine. Conversely, if you're selling wine, you always put a delicious display of cheese, because all the fat content from the cheese will act like spackle in the wine and cover up all the bad things. So to all those wine people out there, they must love Boxcar cheese, because you put a little Boxcar out there and put some shitty wine,
and all of a sudden it's great wine.
Voila. Yeah. Does cheese get washed with wine? Is that also part of the technique? I would assume.
So it definitely is. A lot of people will soak it in a red wine to give it color, flavor. So I'll tell you a quick story, but we actually have a wine. I think we're out of it, but we use Botanist in Barrels. They did a table red wine last year. We had a batch of Winsome that actually we oversalted by about 24 hours. So I came in the next day sitting in the brine of salt. Of course, at that point, it's going to be an extremely salty cheese. So we said, okay, well, we can't throw away $2,000-$3,000 worth of cheese. So what could we do? So we soaked it in wine. We called up them over at Botanist and Barrel. We got a case of their table wine they had. We soaked it in wine. We extracted the salt out of it, brought it back down to proper levels. And then we aged it, and we got this dehydrated grape musk and rubbed it on with olive oil on the rind. We just recently sold out of it. Otherwise, I would have definitely have thrown one of those in with you. But it became a beautiful cheese, very aromatic because of the dehydrated grape musk on it. And it was dried on the rind, but so definitely a cheese that we would like to do again. But obviously,
it sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool. So, and then they have an Umbriaco, which is kind of a wine soaked or wine rubbed Italian style hard cheese. So definitely people do it. So.
Yeah. And that the whole Rhine thing is a little bit of also your guys' calling card or signature on the cheese. And so actually today with the Robbiolo has a ash rind on it. So talk a little bit about that. And then what's also delicious and something I haven't seen before on the red bud, it's got a smoked paprika rind, which just adds so much flavor to that.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I think definitely kind of working in restaurants, I think, as you guys know, kind of you have to
distinguish yourself.
Yeah, exactly. That you want people to enjoy it, how it looks. So the ash came about actually because we started with the Rosie's Robbiolo, which was our first Robbiolo, and just the rind on the Robbiolo in general are so mild. The molds are so, it's such a mild mold where there's so other, there's a lot of dominant molds out there that would love to grow on it. So we kept having trouble with little blue specks of, or specks of blue mold and black mold growing on the cheese. And so we kind of, you know, living in North Carolina and people not necessarily knowing exactly what we were going for, people started asking, hey, why do you have this? There's mold growing on my cheese. We said, oh, yeah, well, you know, cheese obviously is mold. But at the same time, we knew we had to do something about it. So what we ended up doing is actually dipping it in vegetable ash.
By the way, that's a beer vendor calling right now to propose.
I know, right? Right? There you go.
I make a blonde ale.
Yeah. Perfect. We'll take it. But yeah, the vegetable ash actually came about because it neutralizes the really acidic rind and allows the geo mold to grow. So there's a technique in cheese making actually that the ash really comes in handy with. And in our case, it comes more of an exterior, but also it looks awesome as well in the cheese world. Really, it adds two different things. For us, it's more of a technique and also something that adds to the longevity of the cheese. And in the cheese world, they love how it looks, especially contrasting the white interior of the product.
Yeah, it kind of looks like a really cool, almost gray brick.
Yeah,
Something that you, like a stonemason would use to build a house or something like that.
Yeah, just talking about the process of making cheese, I know you had a recent article that was written that was pretty informative, but I love that there's a simplicity to it, and it really is just all about technique. Is kind of I would assume that's really a lot. I mean, you tell me, but what are the main components that go into cheese?
Yeah, no, cheese it's absolutely crazy. Like, the process of making cheese, and I think this is where somebody misquoted me once, but the process of making cheese and the buildup to it is a crazy process. But the simplicity in the products going into it, yes. I mean, cheese consists of milk, salt, rennet, and cultures, and a couple, you know, additives here or there. But more or less, yes, it's a very, very simple when it comes to the ingredients. What makes the cheese is the time, temperature, and the cultures. There are a couple different types of rennet, animal rennet, microbial rennets, some vegetable rennets and stuff, but still it's really the cultures, the times and the temperatures of heating the milk, cooling the milk, the size you cut the curd. Harder cheeses, you're cutting it smaller, so you're extracting more of the, you know, the milk solids and stuff, or you're keeping more of the milk solids. It's a crazy process to see. And I've coming from restaurants, when I first came into this with my sister, I was like, consistency, consistency. And, you know, I was like, we need to just figure it out and everything needs to be streamlined. And then I just gave up, you know, a year or two into it. I was just like, okay, well, the cheese, we use these awesome cultures. They're live, they're active. I've given up on the consistency. We try so hard. I think we do an amazing job in the cheese world locally, but also throughout the country. Majority of our product does leave North Carolina. We love seeing more growth in North Carolina as we, you know, every year we keep growing more in the area, which is great. But also we knew to sustain our business, we had to push elsewhere. And so that's why I think it really, it's how do you set yourself apart? You know, we all use great milk, I think. I mean, we should.
Well, I wonder if that's part of, you know, if you're thinking of like certain cheese growing regions, if you're looking, you know, in Italy, you've got the Parmesans and the Grana Padano, and it's like that hard firm cheese. You look at Wisconsin and they're known for their cheddar. Even California is known for their cheddar. England, they've got their Cotsworth and all, Stilton and all. That was another dumb joke. Is who's the most famous cheese celebrity? Paris Stilton.
Yeah,
I know these are really bad. But does North Carolina are we defining a flavor? I've noticed like we do have a lot like Celebrity, Goat Lady, Chapel Hill and yourselves are all using a lot of goat cheese. So is goat cheese like something that we kind of have our stamp on? We, a collective we of the state, I have nothing to do with it. But would you say that that's something that North Carolina kind of prides themselves on is goat cheese?
I would say yes and no. I mean, I think it's definitely what you see a lot of, because I think it's one of those small, it's a smaller, easier, quicker. I don't know how to really explain that. It's an easier startup. I think in North Carolina, we're really setting ourselves in the American cheese world as like an artisan cheese producers. Because I'd say about 80% of our production is cow's milk. So it's kind of one of those things where I know the first three creameries in North Carolina were goat dairies. And I think that's definitely what a lot of people, you know, see. We've had people at this Rockets Ribiola that I'm holding that you guys had. We've had one of the biggest cheese professionals in the country think it was a goat's milk cheese for 4 years until somebody finally like let her know that it wasn't a goat's milk cheese. So actually, to go back to your point, yes, I think people outside of North Carolina look at us as goat milk producers for sure. So yeah, I guess I kind of rounded that off into, yeah, you're probably pretty much right. So
yeah,
but that makes sense. Yeah, it blew my mind and nobody wanted to correct her either. But anyway, so yeah.
Right. It's like the emperor's new clothes. You know, you can't tell the emperor that he's not wearing anything. From what you guys say, and the understanding is that the culture is what really defines the flavor. Mm-hmm. Is it a proprietary cultures that you have there? Are you purchasing the cultures from? How does that work? And how do you decide what culture goes into what, you know, batch?
Definitely. So there's roughly about three dominant cultures that you'll see throughout cheese. Your Brevet Bacterium linens is that orange rind on the washed rind cheeses. Your penicillin, which is on your cottonseed, which is our bloomy rinds, like on a Brie or a Camembert. And then on our Ribiolas, we have our Geotrichum. And so those are the three dominant molds in the cheese world, along with a bunch of additives. Ours mainly come from one source in Italy that we've been working with since day one. We're one of few American artisans that import from this culture house in general. It's definitely flavor forward, and that's kind of why we've chose to work with them. And it's something that not too many people use. But cultures in general, a lot of people get them from American culture houses where the flavors are what they are. The recipes are a lot easier to follow. They're not as active. Really, the cultures are definitely, I think, what sets us apart in the American artisan cheese world.
I think that kind of makes sense. I mean, culture, in a way, isn't that kind of like almost like another form of just saying like your yeasts? Is that like in a sense, right?
I believe so. Is that?
Yeah. It's, yeah.
Yeah. Like yeasts going back to beer or going back to wine play a very essential part in the flavor profile of making your product. And so that would then beg the question. I mean, that's what's giving you its unique flavor. So that's exactly. Really cool. I do appreciate that you set out forth to be Italian in style and then went so far as to connect yourself using Italian strains of cultures and all, and then even like the beer you said, and kind of keeping that tie, but then of course using American products, using American milks and you know the whether they're goat or cow, and then sometimes both, you blend the goat and the cow together to create I don't know. And what is that technique, or is that style? I mean, obviously you're not the first one to do that, but what is that intention, and what are you trying to achieve by blending the two milks?
Definitely. So I think back in, in Italy, where we kind of took a lot of our recipes and the idea and philosophy behind the cheese, a lot of people had a goat, maybe two sheep, a couple of cows. And it was one of those things where they milked all the animals. They put it into one vat or one kettle. They would cook it. They would culture it and rennet it, and they would make cheese out of it. So you got a lot of European mixed milk cheeses, where in America you don't see it as much because of probably being a little more streamlined. And so we decided, obviously, going with Italian cultures, Italian influenced cheeses, and also, you know, so I don't want to go off on a tangent, but really that's kind of why we wanted to do it, but also from a financial standpoint as well. Milking a goat costs a lot. Milking a cow is a little bit less. So it also allows us to hit the market throughout the country at a reasonably priced point where we can still compete. So that's also another reason of the mixed milk cheeses. Yeah, I think it's in flavor. I think it's a little bit of a calmer flavor in the mixed milk breeze versus an all goat's milk. But we have a little of everything now, so it's pretty cool. We've definitely evolved in our cheeses, going from all cow's milk to mixed milk cheeses to now we're doing mixed milk, cow's milk, and all goat's milk, which is something we pre-pandemic never told ourselves we would do. But hey, things have changed, so.
Right. It's a, yeah, the world has been turned upside down.
Crazy year. So a lot of inventory on goat's milk.
Do you have sights on doing any types of sheep's milk?
We would love to. But just, I don't, if there was somebody crazy enough that wanted to raise sheep around us, we would buy all the milk from them, just to throw that out there. We would even transport
another
it.
Tip for those of you farmers out there, if you have any sheep or you're raising sheep.
But the price would have to be probably unsustainable. So you definitely have to be retiring from an amazing job or have a bunch of a nest egg that you can sink into raising sheep, because it's very hard. Just the culture here in North Carolina, not the culture, but the soil, there's a lot of funguses in it. It's hot, it's humid. They get a lot of hoof rot and a lot of other problems. So financially, no, we would never raise sheep, but we would buy the milk.
I wonder if our good buddy Craig Rogers over there at the Border Springs Farm would ever do any dairy as opposed to just, you know, providing meat, the meat.
The meat, yeah. Why not?
Get on it, Craig.
That's the other thing, too, is, yeah, a lot of the meat sheep are bred to be able to handle this environment, which the dairy sheep, unfortunately, it's just a different animal. And the production, we have a friend that does this cross. I think it's a St. Croix sheep. It's a heritage breed sheep. But the milk production, I think it's, you're like a half a cup a day or something off of them. So it's a lot of input for a little output, I guess.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, like raising a bunch of goats just sounds fun. Like,
yeah,
goats are awesome.
Yeah. And because they also, they can just hang out and be like, you don't, I mean, you need to herd them at some point, but if you have a good amount of land, you don't really need to manage them too much, right?
You'd be surprised. You know, we give our goats lots of land, but yet they want to lay in the barn and eat poop and everything else right in one spot, you know? So my wife would probably tell you a whole nother story. She really does Danny does all the marketing, the graphic design for our business, all the labels and everything, which is amazing. But she also maintains the goat herd. And of course worked for J.A. Piedmont Wine Imports for quite a while. Up until we finally like said, hey, I don't know if this is all working out. We really need your help more. Actually we started milking our goats full time is really what came down to it. She manages the goats pretty much full time along with a couple employees, and it's goats are crazy. If you give them more land, I feel like they're just gonna kind of just
give them an inch, they take a mile.
Well, that's but it. Judging from your personal social media photos, it seems like being a kid being raised with kids, as Matt liked to point out, but the little goats, I mean, like, what a unique environment to be raised on. You're just like, you guys might have cats or dogs. I've got 75 goats.
Soon to be 150 goats.
Which right now you're at, 55,000 pounds of cheese? That's what your production is for the year, and then that's growing from what you'd talked about, but I don't even know, like, I have no comprehension of what that means. That sounds like a tremendous amount of cheese, but you're still probably in the cheese world considered boutique?
Yes, very much so. I mean, I can compare you. I don't even know who to compare you to. But yeah, I mean, in the cheese world in North Carolina, we're like third in productions, like Ashe County, Goat Lady. We go neck to neck with them as far as production. But it's per poundage, in the artisan cheese world, we are considered pretty small. But we're definitely in the large market. So I think it's a really cool thing to be next to Cowgirl Creamery, Point Reyes, and all the big producers on the shelf in the West Coast stuff, which is awesome because 30% of our cheese is out on the West Coast, which is really cool. We've got great distribution out there and some customers. So it's really cool to be able to be in a market like that. It makes us feel good about, one, our price point, but also, two, about our product and stuff like that up against theirs. We have room to grow, but still, we don't want to grow too big. We just, you know.
How have you figured that out? Because most people that we talk to are small family business owners like yourself. They start in state and then somewhat branch out, you know, but it's still locally. But it seems like you guys are almost the opposite. You said, I think only 10% of your cheese stays in state. So how were you able to be successful outside of North Carolina?
Sorry, let me rewind. We're about 50% of our cheese is in state. Sorry.
Oh,
yeah, about
50% 30,
about 30, okay. 30% is going to California, and then the rest would be kind of divvied up to between New York, Washington State, and other places.
Okay.
But really, so when we designed the business at first, we knew that we calculated all the restaurants that we could possibly hit. We all the retailers locally, and we said, okay, is this enough to pay our bills? If we were to build a facility that we general contracted it ourselves, but it's an amazing building. We got all the equipment we wanted, but we still, you know, we cut all the corners we could just to maintain, to still be able to do this. And we said, okay, this isn't enough cheese for our bottom line. So we knew going into it that distributors were going to be a lower price point, but it was going to hit the volume right away. So then we were just banking off, obviously, having a great product right away to be able to approach these distributors, sales and stuff. But really, a lot of our cheese would go through a distributor, go to Atlanta, and then back to North Carolina. We figure a lot of that logistics out now to where we do a lot of it here in North Carolina ourselves, which has helped us out. But we knew going into it that us pushing the cheese outside of North Carolina was going to be a main focus of our business to be able to succeed. And we knew we'd always come back to focusing on North Carolina because it's here. It's a cheaper sale. From logistics, it makes sense too. So.
Well, and you mentioned that your audio got a little crackly for a moment, but you did mention the Durham Farmers Market. That's where I was able to pick up all this cheese over the weekend. And I will say, you know, in this modern time, in this unique time that we have where everybody is staying home, quarantining, social distancing, the Durham Farmers Market was hopping. I mean, in a respectable, responsible way, but you know, there's quite a few people that were out there. I know, like Melina's handmade pasta was right next door to you. We had the Trujillos love our pasta, so we bought a bunch of pasta to take home that night too. And then then I was gifted all this cheese, and then everybody looked at me and wanted to like attack me, and. It was great too, just like, you know, behind the veil a little bit. I was laughing because then Jacob Bohm, a friend of the show, who's a friend of ours and, you know, of Snap Pea Underground, fantastic chef, he texted me and said, "Hey, did I just see you downtown right now at the farmer's market?" And I'm like, "Oh, yeah." And he said, "I love you and all. I'm in a line, a really long line, so I'm not going to get out of it to go say hi, but I definitely wanted to say hi here." And I'm like, "What are you buying?" He's like, "Brussels sprouts." I'm like, "That is so Jacob Bohm right now. I'm going to stand in a line for Brussels sprouts." But it was really great to see kind of commerce back to an extent, and, you know, with a little bit of structure, and, you know, everybody, they had it set up where everybody's moving in one circle. You can't like really go backwards, and you can kind of go through the farmer's market. So for those that do want to get some fresh vegetables and all, if you haven't gone, that was really amazing, and it felt refreshing. The kids playing and running around, there were so many dogs everywhere. It just felt like normal life, even just for a glimpse, for a little moment. So I just wanted to like speak about that because it felt great, and get out there and support some local businesses, because I don't need to be the one to tell you that everybody's been struggling a little bit here and there, and so all of that support definitely helps out. Lastly, just to know, speaking about distribution, where can people, obviously they can get at the farmer's market, but if they're not in Durham or in the neighboring area, where can they in North Carolina find boxcar cheese?
Yeah, definitely. So other than the Durham Farmers Market every Saturday from 10 to 12 in the winter, they can go to any of your Weaver Streets, Raleigh, Chapel Hill, Carrboro, Hillsborough. Then we have all the Whole Foods locally, of course, and out of state as well. Actually, at the Wegmans grocery stores, Wegmans, they've done a great job bringing in local cheeses, Chapel Hill Creamery, and of course, our cheese there is a great presentation. They have us in this big, beautiful case. So definitely really cool to see that as well. And then, of course, a lot of local shops. Loaf does great cut pieces, Bodega, Durham Co-op. You know, if they have cheese, then they probably have one or two pieces of ours, which has been great because everybody's been absolutely so supportive through these crazy times, because, you know, I know we experienced a couple crazy months there for a little bit. But But yeah, just everybody being so supportive. Even a Broken Spoke Farm out here that they do a little self-serve ice cream. They've been selling our cheese, and they're competing with the Durham Whole Foods in sales. It's pretty crazy to see.
Wow.
So yeah, really, really nuts. So I know I'm missing people, but at the same time, I mean, we've got even restaurants like Hawthorne and Wood and the Gocciolina, people that have been kind of still buying cheese throughout the whole thing. Has been great. Pizza Toro. So there's been so many that have been kind of, you know, they're open and closing and everything, but still, you know, showing support and stuff.
Yeah.
And as we like to as well, that's most of the places. We also have a relief box, which is good for this podcast. If there are some industry people, it's really designed for everybody, but we've been doing it since the beginning of the pandemic. We offer a cheese relief box. It's free. You go onto our website, you sign up for it. It was basically to help our friends in the restaurant industry to kind of give them a little something special, you know, throughout everything with people losing jobs and all the uncertainty and stuff. And that's still on there. We've sold, I mean, I don't say sold, but we've given away about 300 plus of those so far. And it's about, you know, 3 to 4 pounds of cheese, just kind of a variety of what we give our employees and stuff like that. And so, yeah, those are most of the places you can find our product. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, yeah. Not to mention that your milk purveyor, while everybody else was kind of shutting down production, you guys said, we're keep the production coming. We're going to take it all. And I think he would have actually had to shut down if you guys didn't continue production.
Yeah, we were very in a very good position to be able to say, you know, to just keep producing cheese because, you know, I mean, I don't think anybody knew how long we were going to be, things were going to go on. And we needed, you know, we loved his milk. And yeah, for us, we needed to fill our coolers and also, but the coolers filled really quickly. And then we were like, oh, wait, the other guy's not making cheese yet. You still need us to take this? No, I'm joking. We were like, of course. So that's really when the relief boxes kicked in. And of course, all the cheese we donated to the food banks and stuff like that. It was one of those things. We were here anyways. Our facility is, we're paying bills regardless if we shut down or not. You know, so we are also lucky enough. We did get a PPP loan, which was awesome because we basically funneled that right, you know, through to our employees. We hired more employees to be able to do these wrap cheeses for the food banks and some other organizations and stuff like that. So, for us, it was a good way to bridge those 2.5-3 months of uncertainty. But then 4 months later, we didn't have enough milk. So we were really, it was a perfect way to secure this confidence of this farm going forward and letting them know that we're here for them regardless of what could possibly happen. So yeah, it's one of those things where it was from our bottom of our hearts. It's one of those things we would love to do, but a business that does not actually generate any income and has not in 5 years, it's hard just to say, yeah, we'll take your milk, let's donate cheese. But it's all worked out and we'll have another break-even year, which is, I mean, it puts a huge smile on my face. So, I mean, most people won't be able to see it, but yeah, as our business, we're very happy about that. So, yeah.
We'll screenshot it because you do have a big smile.
Yeah.
Well, that's really yeah. Unbelievable. And thank you for doing that. Before we do get out of here, I actually have I need to get back to the technical questions for a second. And there is some selfish reasons in there that I have. But just answer me this. So you have the categories, the soft ripe, semi-soft, and spreadable and hard cheeses. Mm-hmm. So at what point in the cheese making process do you know what is going to be the texture? And then at what point do you know, is this going to be a Robbiola? Are we going to make this into our Lissome? Are we going to make this into our whichever type it might be?
Definitely. So all of our cheeses, we use whole milk. So there's no variation there. But basically, it really comes down to the temperature and what you're going to culture and the culture that you add to the cheese. So
okay.
Some cheeses, like our semi-soft cheeses and some of our, what other ones? Actually, our semi-soft, like our Taleggios, are going to be a culture that does not acidify as quick. So they're actually a higher pH. So it's a different consistency. Where our Ribbiolas and like a fresh Chev or fresh goat cheese, we add a culture that's going to acidify a little bit quicker. So, you know, other than the temperature and your culture that's into it, going into it, you kind of need to know those, but also how you cut the cheese. If you actually cut the cheese smaller, and press a lot of the whey out, you know, it's going to be a harder cheese. You know, there's probably six different steps that are going to adjust the texture of the cheese. And you better know that before you add your cultures, because you need to weigh those cultures going into it.
Okay.
But then also how you press them. You can take a fresh goat cheese and press it into a mold, and you can get like a ricotta salata of something versus a fresh goat cheese off the same cheese. So it's with that said, yeah. It's
so that would be at the end, though. That's
that
when you're
would be at the end. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So it's all throughout the process. It's how you cook the curd. It's how you cut the curd. It's how you press the curd. And then it's how long you press the curd and how you brine the curd. Even we brine in a salt bath. Some people dry salt. We're not designed to make super hard cheeses. We don't have presses, like Goat Lady or Chapel Creamer, where they might have a couple presses. So our hard cheeses, we mechanically press. So with that said, just different techniques, you know.
Okay.
Make different
now the cheeses. The reason I'm asking, and I'll throw this out there, is, you know, we've been known in Cedar Grove to make a blend or two, as we made some wine with Botanist and Barrel. So,
awesome.
Should you need our help or consultation on a proprietary North Carolina food and beverage cheese, Max and I are willing to come out and lend our palates to you.
I love it. I love it. No, that is perfect. You guys, how about you think of a cheese? Because every time I come up with a new cheese, my sister is like, we're making another cheese. But then she ends up smiling when it's made and customers are enjoying it and everything.
She's happy.
So, yeah. Okay. Yeah. But,
well, but what do you think about that, Max? Another collaboration on Cedar Grove?
I think so. Maybe we can do a cheese that's not your own. Nacho cheese. before you get out of here, we're going to have to, when we do see you in person, maybe I'll come by the old Durham Farmers Market and hand you some of these gifts, because we have a couple of fantastic products that are sponsored in part by Boss Coffee, which is a Japanese product. It's flash brewed. It's available only on Amazon. It comes in three flavors, black, vanilla, and cafe au lait. And flash brew is uniquely a Japanese process where it is brewed hot, chilled fast for optimal flavor and texture. And it's ready to drink. It's canned coffee. It's the most popular canned coffee across Asia, Australia, and New Zealand, which are just right off the coast of North Carolina. It's very, very local stuff. But if you do want to get some coffee, you can go to Amazon, search Boss Coffee, and you can receive a 10% discount if you use the NCFB podcast promo code.
Yeah. And one other thing, you know, you were talking about places where you can buy boxcar cheese, and I'm wondering if you are in the Triangle Wine Company locations, because they sell some cheese as well. And if you're not, we'll make the connection. But
there you go.
Yeah. So soon, coming soon to the Triangle Wine Company, which also has all your needs for great wine and beer and vermouth and all that kind of stuff. They are fantastic. They have four locations, Holly Springs, Waverly Place in Cary. They're out in Morrisville and then even in Southern Pines. New place very soon to come in North Raleigh. Don't forget to use the NCFB promo code there also to get a nice discount. And while you're there.
And while you're here at the studio, we just got our new ice cream delivery from Proof Alcohol Ice Cream. We have peppermint moonshine. We have pumpkin pie spice, as well as all the fantastic flavors like coconut rum and bourbon caramel. Oh, my God. Strawberry moonshine. We are lousy with ice cream right now at the kitchen, and it is filled with 7% alcohol in every pint container. So enjoy and think differently about your dessert. Go to proofalcoholicecream.com and let them know that we sent you when you go over there and get it. They're in those fantastic branded red freezers that you can find at Triangle Wine Co. or Triangle Wine Company. But you can also get them at a Lowe's or a Harris Teeter all across the state and even out there in South Carolina. So check them out. Please support them as well. Austin, we have had a fantastic time. Matt, did you get your cheese episode itch scratched?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't mean it's the last one. You know, like we have to have a full episode maybe with Alexander Cass, as we've talked about. But yes, for now, sufficiently scratched.
Yeah. And we are going to go home and we're going to eat all of this cheese. Which is amazing. I really appreciate the time that you and your sister spent. Your sister, maybe not as much time. You know, she had to go get that rennet on the cheese. But no, I kid. So I really appreciate you both coming out on the show. Matt, you got anything else before we leave?
Yeah, thank you very much, Austin. And thank your sister for us and your wife, Danny. And everybody out there. You know where to get it now, so go out, get yourself some boxcar handmade cheese, and you will eat very merrily.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for listening to the NCF&B podcast. And if you've stuck with us this long, review us on iTunes, and remember, 5 stars are encouraged.